Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Because they were talking about something that was so much huger, that was opening up an completely different side to the city, and also something so personal and something so valuable, I felt that it would be ridiculous for me to not share it simply because I didn't have confidence in myself. You know, so I had to sort of get over myself and write the book.
Welcome to the Adventure Podcast and this episode with Taran Khan. Taran is an acclaimed Indian author and journalist whose work delves into the intricate themes of conflict, identity and belonging. Her work is varied and broad, but she's extensively covered issues of war, displacement and the profound effects of conflict on individuals and communities. The focus of this episode is her book, Shadow City, A Woman Walks Kabul, where she shares intimate experiences and keen observations while navigating the streets of Kabul, Afghanistan. In this episode, we take a close look at how Taran became the woman she is, her family connection to Afghanistan, and why she originally decided to travel to Kabul before getting pretty deep and philosophical about what she found during her time there, how it affected and changed her, how she managed to do what she did, and also critically why that work is important and relevant. Kabul is a place that inevitably conjures up instant images in our brains. And if, like me, your bias is created by the news you've been fed over the last few decades, then prepare to have your perceptions of Kabul and Afghanistan completely changed. Before we begin, I'd like to talk to you about Sidetracked magazine, our sister publication. Sidetracked is an incredible quarterly journal that celebrates authentic stories of adventure and exploration. You can find out more at sidetracked.com. I'd also like to take a quick moment to push you in the direction of our charitable partner, the Martin Moran Foundation. They're a wonderful organization working to get young people from disadvantaged backgrounds into the outdoors. You can find information about how you can support them on our Instagram bio at The Adventure Podcast. Finally, if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do subscribe on iTunes and leave us an honest review. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience. Okay, over to Taran Khan. Cool. So let's get started. Thanks so much for doing this. Eventually, after a few failed attempts to actually speak, I think the logical place to start is always the start. So if you could give me some background on who you are and what you do, whatever that means to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here also. After a few failed attempts, as you said, I'm Taran. I'm a journalist and a nonfiction writer. And I have written a book called Shadow City, A Woman Walks Kabul. I didn't start thinking of it as a travel book. I was in Afghanistan in the years between 2006 to 2013. And I went there to work with Afghan filmmakers and media professionals. And I really loved it there the first time I went. I made a lot of friends. I really enjoyed the city. I was only in Kabul. And the energy of the place was really incredible to me, quite unlike what I had anticipated from, you know, stuff I'd seen on TV or what I'd read, which was all very mainstream stuff. And I hadn't anticipated finding a city so full of history, of energy, of people just wanting to tell stories. And that really, kind of drew me in a really big way. And I went back every opportunity I could get. I would travel there with my husband the first time we went. We had a friend with us, but both of us made really, really good friends there. And they were incredibly generous, and they led us into their lives in this very, very Kabuli way, I think. And through them, I found so many wonderful stories and such interesting moments and such interesting insights that I felt like I had to write about them. And I was writing as a journalist from there for Indian papers and also international publications. But like you mentioned a while ago, I felt like a lot of the interesting stuff was just leaving it out on the cutting floor. And I felt very strongly that the things I was reading about Kabul, even that I was writing about Kabul, even longer stories or longer feature stories, didn't really get to what I was seeing or didn't really get to the heart of the city I was experiencing in this very emotional way. So in 2013, which was the last time I went to Kabul, I started writing the book after I left, which I think is not that unusual. But I was reporting it from the period between 2006 to 13. So that's the arc of the book. And I think after the book came out, it's been, you know, it won an award for being a travel book, which was a little bit unusual for me to think of because in my head I was writing a book of narrative nonfiction. But since then, I think it's really become something I've owned because I really find the genre of travel writing to be capacious enough to accommodate first the format, which I had, which was sort of, it's not a memoir. I was very clear that the heroine of the book was not the journalist who goes to this your city and, you know, his or her life changes. I was definitely not the most interesting thing in Kabul at all. But I am in the book. And I think the reason for that was because I could be the sort of doorway for readers or a window for readers to look at the city. I could connect it to my own family, my own stories from India, from Aligarh, which is my hometown. But it's also a story about the city. So I think travel writing lets you do that. It lets you switch voice. It lets you switch between time, between space. And also, I realized there are not a lot of Indian women winning awards for travel writing. So I sort of totally owned it because it's important that there are so many different kind of travel stories coming out from the world, not just from one certain perspective or from, you know, explaining the world to readers living in the West, but the other way around as well. Everything, actually. So just in terms of there being so many interesting stories out there. I think that's the brief intro to what I do and why.
Amazing. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, obviously, and I'm sure that Kabul will dominate a lot of this conversation, and it should. But to give us some context, I kind of want to go back in time a little bit and talk about your origins and your childhood and what life was like when you were growing up and what inspired you to start writing.
I grew up in what we call a small town. It's not really a small town. It's very, very big for you know, the UK. But in India, it's called a small town. And it's called Aligarh. It's in the north of the country, about, say, 3 hours north from Delhi. And I grew up there in the late 80s, 90s. It was a very different time. This is pre-liberalization India. And most of my time, I didn't have a life outside of the house other than school. And that wasn't unusual again. So a lot of my time was with books. That was my social life. That was my, you know, exploration. That was all the excitement that I got. And I really held on to it then. So I read a lot. And my home is this old, it's called it's a sort of old style bungalow kind of a house, very ramshackle, full of my cousins. We were all growing up in this very big joint family. And we had these old cupboards, which were massive, or they seemed massive at the time. And they were full of just this jumble of books that people had put in at different times of their lives. So I inherited this whole mass of books that I dived into. And the afternoons, usually, when it would be very hot and all the grown-ups would be sleeping, that was the time that I would just pick out whatever came to hand. So I ended up reading very, very widely, quite unintentionally. And this was my paternal family. My maternal grandfather was also a scholar, a translator, a poet. And I also got his bookshelves as well. So he had a lot of Russian writers in translation. He read a lot of Urdu poetry. And so I got my hands on a lot of very varied stuff. Like I read a lot of P.G. Woodhouse and George Tenth and also a lot of Dostoevsky and Chekhov. So you know, from a very early age, I saw what reading could be. It could be this form of exploration. It could be a form of inhabiting the world without leaving your house. And that was a very, very big deal for me. And I think at that summer, at that point, I decided that I wanted to be a journalist because that was a very good way to get out into the world and to explore the world and to taste everything that's going on without having to be an entrenched part of anything. So I think I love the idea of being able to move between different voices, between different struggles, between different issues, and being able to also be outside of them and to talk about them to a wider audience. But pretty much as far as I can remember, I just wanted to be a journalist or to work in writing in some way.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And you've kind of touched on something I definitely wanted to bring up in this conversation, which is this idea of kind of what came first, the desire to tell stories or the desire to travel. It sounds like the latter, but I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, I think very almost simultaneous. I think for me, they were not separate because, you know, telling stories meant leaving. And that was very attractive. Of course, over time, coming home has also become very attractive. And I think it's that's just a function of age. But also, I think it's just, you know, the idea of storytelling is so transformative. And some of the best storytellers I've known are the grandmothers, you know, who were deeply enmeshed in their own time and their own spaces. But they have these incredible stories, which are also very familiar. Like, it doesn't matter if you go to a completely different culture. You very often end up hearing stories that resonate with stories I heard during my childhood, for instance. And, you know, right now I'm visiting my aunt and we were talking about stories that my grandmother, which is her mother, told her, and then stories her grandmother, so my great-grandmother, told her. And the stories were incredibly similar, but they're also, but now I've heard stories in Afghanistan, you know, and they're all very, very, they touch on something quite, I mean, childlike in all of us, or, you know, which is obvious, but it's also something really beautiful to see that storytelling can be something that needs you to be out, but it can also be something that transforms where you are also quite fundamentally.
Yeah. And so when did you first begin writing professionally? Were you getting into kind of the author world, or were you working as a journalist?
Yeah, I started out as a journalist very much by plan. I was very determined to be a journalist, and I studied journalism and my undergraduate degree. I have a master's degree in mass communication, so I did documentary, radio, and I also do multimedia work. So that was really helpful in that it gives you a lot of tools to work with. But pretty soon I realized that I like the solitariness of writing and the collaborativeness of film, which is a kind of alchemy, which where you get a bunch of people to give their best and to contribute to this beautiful shared vision, was not really what I was good at. Although I can see how it works so beautifully for other people. But I like the control of being alone on a text. And I also like having to go somewhere else away from what other people think what a text should be, and having only my, and write with freedom and write with complete, you know, abandon without caring what happens to it. So I switched quite quickly to writing, but I think a lot of the tools I learned for cinema, for photographs, for audio especially, are very much there in the text because, you know, I think writing about place is in a way using all your senses. And that's definitely something I learned from, especially I think from radio and from audio storytelling. So if you read my work, you'll see a lot of the dialogue, I think, is influenced by the experience in that. And so I just, you know, started working as a journalist and worked for a brief while, well, not that brief, 3 years, in a mobile newsroom, working for a Sunday paper, which was excellent. And again, I had moved to Mumbai recently before I took up the job. It was a great way to find the city for me. I really enjoyed exploring it through the cities I was chasing. Very different kind of writing than what I ended up doing in Kabul. But I think, again, it's a good way to be able to be out in the city and to explore it by learning to tell stories. So yeah, I did that. I still do journalistic writing, less now. I think more of long form or interested in writing longer work that isn't necessarily about news topics, but still very much a journalist and a nonfiction writer.
Yeah, and I get the sense we could do a whole hour on kind of the Mumbai years, but
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're really here to talk about Kabul, or that's where I'd like to go. And I guess to lead us into that, it would be good to understand, you know, the world is a very big place and there are lots of stories and lots of people, lots of issues, lots of cultures. Why Kabul? What was your connection to Afghanistan and Kabul in particular?
That's a really good question. And it wasn't something I'd planned in the sense that it wasn't on a list of places that I'd made plans to visit or that I had on an agenda. But it was very much on my consciousness for two, in hindsight, quite silly reasons. One was that my paternal side of the family, we had this vision in our heads that, you know, our ancestors are Pashtuns. So we felt in a way that we had this very long ago connection to Afghanistan. And it was entirely imagined to the extent that when I got to Afghanistan, I realized that my ancestry actually had nothing at all to do with Afghanistan. They were actually from, you know, the other side of the border, which is now Pakistan. But very sweetly, my friends in Kabul, they were like, oh, don't worry about it. You know, you're one of us. They kind of didn't let that get to me and they accepted me. But that was one reason I had this sort of big affinity. Now, this, it wasn't factual at all, but it gave me this emotion to land with in Kabul, which was of connection. And I think that saw me through a lot of stuff. It just kind of helped me land there and say, what's going on? This is so great. You know, it's amazing. And that was, now again, in hindsight, it was a good emotion to land with, of curiosity, of enthusiasm. And I think if that hadn't been there, and if there was more fear or anxiety, then I would have had a very different experience of Kabul. And maybe it wouldn't have been the big part of my life that it is now. So I am happy for that. But that was, to answer your question, that's one of the reasons why I was so excited to get to Afghanistan. And the other was that at the time, in 2006, it was very, very much in the news. You know, it was every news agency, every journalist, everyone working in humanitarian work was interested in Afghanistan. So it was a very, very catchy topic. I wouldn't say that was a big motivation, but I was definitely very curious to see what was going on there. And I think, again, just simply because it was a space which had this connection with India as well. Because we had this beautiful story written by Rabindranath Tagore called The Kabuliwala, which is about an Afghan man who sells dry fruits and he comes to what was then Calcutta. And the story is about this very beautiful friendship between him and a little girl who reminds him of his daughter. And that was, I think, the first instance I'd heard of Kabul and Afghanistan. So it was a very beautiful bond, but a very ephemeral bond, something that was there, but not there. I think that was the reason. So when I got the opportunity to work with the Afghan media producers, both me and my husband really jumped and we took it.
Okay. I mean, you sort of hinted at it with that last sentence, but what was your plan? You know, did you just go there and wait to see or?
We went there to work. So we had a sort of assignment to do the first few months we were there. But that very quickly, I realized we were supposed to be teaching Afghans things which they already knew. And that, unfortunately, was a pattern I saw across a lot of these so-called training projects and capacity building projects, which are all terms I have now a fair amount of allergy to, because I think they are, you know, not really rooted in any reality. Anyway, in my experience, I found that the Afghans I was supposed to be teaching things to really knew their jobs already. The best I could do was collaborate with them. And that's what we ended up doing. And we ended up making, you know, short films, short productions, short audio productions with them. But during the initial weeks we were with them, we realized very quickly that there was a lot going on. And a lot of it was in the media, because at that time, there was a lot of investment in Afghan media. And still, I feel like one of the true success stories of the post-2001 intervention was the Afghan media. You have a whole generation of Afghan journalists who have grown up committed to the ideas of press freedom, of journalism as a public service. And unfortunately, most of them now are not living in the country, or if they are, they're having an incredibly hard time working. But those are the people we ended up meeting. A lot of them were doing, you know, work on their own, so we kept getting asked back to collaborate with them, which was a really good way also for me to spend a lot of time in the city without having to work as a journalist exclusively. And I think, again, in hindsight, this was really helpful for me in writing the book, because when you go as a journalist and you already have a list of articles you have to do and questions you have to ask for that, and it's very transactional, then the relationship is of running through your questionnaire. And in a way, I think most journalists, or at least my experience, would agree with this, that you go with a sort of already written story in your head, and you just need the quotes to hang it on. And some things might change, but more or less, you know what you want. And that's not a good way to write, I think, as that's just not a good way to do journalism, because you have to be open to everything changing, to being having your ideas completely challenged, to finding something that you didn't even know existed. And that, you know, kind of has to that be the big idea that then you run with. So I had that freedom there to be a journalist without having to churn out news reports or having to meet some kind of, agenda at any time. And so that's where a lot of my work came from just hanging out with friends, you know, from these long evenings at home with the people we shared our house with, from walking around initially, which was relatively easy, going to have lunch with my colleagues, or, you know, Friday picnics, which are a huge thing. Like, they're just on this Olympic scale of preparation and, you know, just the number of food that you take and the activities that you plan. So it's just beautiful, you know, just a lot of banal activities that really transformed how I was seeing this city. That the thing about Kabul, which I find over and over, is that it's a city that you feel like you know because you've read so much about it, or so many people have told you things about it. But it's not a city that's well understood. And I was being able to understand it by just spending idle time there. I think that was the big advantage. And being able to return over and over again from 2006 to 2013. Without any real agenda in terms of the journalism.
Yeah, and I kind of mentioned this really briefly to you before we started, but I think it's kind of the elephant in the room for me a little bit that, you know, I have this inherent prejudice as a white British man of the way I see Kabul and Afghanistan as a whole. And when I think of Kabul, I think of the war. And I recognize that that is, you know, profoundly wrong in so many ways, but it's what I've been exposed to. Because of the news over the years, that was all I ever saw. And I kind of hope over the course of this conversation, we can reframe Kabul a little bit for me and for those who see it the way that I do. And as we start to do that, I think actually it would be really useful for you to kind of almost, as a writer and journalist, kind of set the scene. What does Kabul look like, feel like, smell like, sound like, as you know it?
Yeah, I think what you said is absolutely true, that there, and I don't think it's just you. I think, you know, it's not entirely based on who you are. It's also based on what you read and what you get to read and what you get to see from the city that shapes how we see it. Unfortunately, and this is against untrue, the primacy was given to voices from outside, from people like you and me, who go there as as travelers, and we write about it or we talk about it. And I think that has, to some degree, changed, that we can now listen to Afghan voices, or that, you know, Afghan accounts of the place are now a little bit better known than at least when I went. But yeah, I went there also very much shaped by the same kind of stories. And I think the very first thing that really was remarkable for me was the physical beauty of the place. I mean, it's just such a stunning place. And you always hear about it, but always framed by this reference to ruined beauty, and which is true. But I think over and over again, the recurring, trope for me was how much I would hear Kabul described either as a place of ruin or as a place of resilience despite being ruined. And reality falls always between these two poles. It's never that simple. And when I saw it in 2006, it was a very, very relatively still small city. It was growing at that time. And by the time I left in 2013, it had become very large. It had sort of spread beyond the mountains that had enclosed it. The houses, which I'd seen in 2006, were a lot of, you know, larger pillars or bungalows with larger gardens. They had been broken down, and there were multi-story apartments there. The roads had become better in some senses. In some senses, they had started flooding. So it was a city growing. And in that sense, it was like a city we all know, you know, with the usual irritations and the traffic jams and the sounds and the noises that you expect to hear in a city with an incredibly, like, diverse and growing population. I think the more striking thing about Kabul to me also was how full of full of history it was. Every step you could encounter a different version of the past. And this was, again, different to the one note history that I had read about, which was almost entirely defined by war. And so, you know, I went on accompanied a friend who's an archaeologist to a dig on a hill sort of on the edges of Kabul. And I always remember that because it was it obviously we were at an elevation and we could see this valley, which is called Shodai Salihin. And it was a burial ground before, long before it was a, you know, space for Zoroastrian holy sites. It was a space for Hindu holy sites and then for Muslim shrines. So it was like this archaeology also of the city, because I could see the Buddhist stupa that he had excavated. I could see the mausoleums of dead Afghan kings. I could see the homes of people that were coming closer and closer to the stupa because people were building their houses. And they were almost circling the site, this empty site. And you could see how diverse this past was. There were so many strands of humanity and how many people had passed through it as well, because it was also on the crossroads to this entire, you know, connection between Central Asia, India, the whole sort of pilgrimage sites that had passed through it. So it was really incredible that how, in a sense, alive it was, even though it seemed so ruined.
Yeah, and given all of these experiences, at what point did you think, okay, you know, I'm going to stay here or I'm going to come back here time and time again and I'm going to create something bigger than a single article? Was there a kind of trigger point?
Yeah, I think I want to come back here was very almost straight off the bat, you know, almost as soon as I got there. And also, I think for me, just like I said, the way I was able to get into Kabul was in the company of very ordinary working class Kabulis. I didn't, thankfully, didn't have to stay in a compound. I didn't have to, you know, get in an armored car and be driven around. Had that happened, maybe I wouldn't have wanted to go back. But because I was able to walk around in 2006 with relative freedom, it was quite simple for me to just be out and to go shopping or to buy bread or to, you know, go look at the museum or to the parks. And all of that really made it quite easy for me to say I would love to come back. The writing, I think, around 2009, I started getting frustrated with the kind of writing that I was doing, in the sense that it was really seemed to be sticking to the very stereotyped ideas of Kabul that I was getting, that were not resonating with me anymore. That was clearly dissonant for me. And also, I think a big influence that I haven't mentioned so far was my maternal grandfather, and that he had never been to Kabul, but he was a big shaper of this book because he would keep telling me things that he knew about Kabul simply by having read about it or being so fluent in that culture that spans across from Northern India into Central Asia, Iran, Afghanistan. And he just knew stuff. Like, he would tell me things about the city where I would go. And then I would be like, okay, that's interesting. And then I'd come back and tell him something I'd found. And then he would add to it. So it was this, there was this parallel city growing, I think, with his study and his bookshelf as the bridge between these two places, Aligarh and Kabul. And I wanted to find a way to describe this connection, to describe this the city within a city. I was also having a lot of conversations with Kabulis about their memories. And I was finding very clearly that the city I was moving through was not the same city that they were moving through. And this was, again, interesting for me to delve into. In what ways had we lost a city? We all lose cities. You know, none of us are living in the same places that we've grown up in. All cities change. But Kabul has changed in a very different way. Because the very idea of a city, Kabul as a city with history, where the past, where the cosmopolitanism had been erased. It was almost like in 2001, it was had nothing before. Or the discussion was always in terms of before the Taliban and after the Taliban, as there was nothing before that. So all of these, you know, fallacious ideas were being eroded very quickly, and I was realizing that there had to be a way to write about it. So I started writing longer and longer pieces. But even there, it wasn't easy to fit in everything that I wanted to say. So I think around 2011, I realized that I did want to write a book, but it took a long while to find the form for it because, you know, so much depends on the structure of how the book goes, which is not something I'd known when I'd, you know, got into it. But it changed form quite a few times because it started out as, like I said, narrative nonfiction. I thought, you know, straight up reportage. At one point, I wanted to do linked essays about Kabul because that gave me the sort of freedom to just take up ideas and to riff on them, which a lot of the book still is. It's not defined by issues. It's defined by thoughts or about. It's a, more about musings about certain things. How was I supposed to put all that into a single book? Was I supposed to struggle that that took me from 2013 onwards till the publication of the book, which was 2019?
Yeah, because correct me if I'm wrong or if you disagree with this, but I feel like your writing is a combination of kind of journalism and travel writing, but it's also deeply personal, which I guess is slightly rarer for somebody who's a through and through journalist, which you aren't. You know, you're sort of, there's this kind of polymath approach to it. Is that deliberate? Is it because you were seeking something bigger than just telling others' stories? Or was that just a natural writing style that you found?
I think a bit of both. Like I said, there was a lot of frustration at writing in the journalistic voice, which I was sure wouldn't work for something of this sort. I knew that it had to be more personal, for sure. And I was also keen to bring in the connections that had informed the way I see Kabul, because that just made it so much richer. Like when my grandfather told me, for instance, about the Shahnameh, which is this Persian epic, which every Persian reader across the world knows. And he told me that one of the stories in the Shahnameh is about Rudaba, who's a princess of Kabul. And she falls in love with Sal, who's a prince who she's never seen before. And he's never seen her before, but they fall desperately in love and they're determined to marry. And there is a lot of opposition to their marriage initially. And they both fight for their happiness. And Rudaba is this incredible character who gives a speech where she just says, "Oh, you know, nothing doing, I'm marrying this guy," basically. And so when I read this, when my grandfather told me this beautiful poetry about Kabul, about this wonderful woman who had been a princess of Kabul, and then I went back and I walked through the streets and I saw, you know, street names alluding to poetry, alluding to authors, that shifted it in a way for me that I was keen to let the reader into. That couldn't happen without it being a personal voice, of course, and connecting both these worlds that I was moving between. But like I said, initially, I was also very, very, very sure it wasn't a memoir. So in that sense, it is something that I stumbled upon, the style, that it let me bring in myself when I'm useful, but also not let the guide be the character that you're interested in. I think the writing style being a combination of these different, you know, I borrowed a lot, I think, from novelistic writing. I borrow a lot of tools from fiction because I think truth-telling is really maybe only truly possible when you're writing poetry, I think. My own sense is that poetry is the truest form of nonfiction because you work with image, you work with concise language, and you leave the reader then to make sense of that image. That's something you can really distill the many, many words down into a few lines. I think that's the only truest form of writing nonfiction. But I'm unfortunately no good at it, so I write longer prose. but that's very much the mood of the book. And I think that is my natural style, which I was, you know, happy to spread out. And the really excruciating part was taking out things. And this may be something that resonates with writers. I don't know. But I thought everything was interesting. I thought, this is great. Like, who wouldn't want to read this little vignette about, you know, the different kinds of marzipan you find at Kabul's bazaars, or the different kinds of baklavas that you see, or 700 kinds of wedding dresses that you could buy. So that was a bit, that was, I think, really the process of finding the structure, which was walking. And I think walking was liberating for me because it was something that's so close to my own experience of it being this complicated task. Like I said, when I was growing up, we were not supposed to just be out in the bazaar or just wandering around. That wasn't something, you know, young women like me did. So when I was walking, I always had this like posture of urgency that I was doing something important, you know, don't mess with me, and, you know, elbows out kind of attitude. And when I got to Kabul, this was the first thing I heard, was that you shouldn't walk anywhere. And that wasn't because I was a woman. It was just because I'd come from outside. But it landed very differently for me. So I think because that was, you know, almost my through line into Kabul, that became the through line of the book. And obviously a lot of the walks are into memory They're into the imagination. They're into fables. They're into, you know, mythology, and which is a great way for me as a writer to be able to move between all these different things that I want to talk about, but still be in Kabul with the reader. I think it also opens up the city for the reader in a way, because walking is an intensely personal act. It's how you experience the world mostly. It's how you decide that this earth is mine, even in a way, when you put your feet on it. And there's a lot of cities where you don't actually walk, like where I am right now in the United States, in the suburbs of Atlanta. I'm the only person walking very often on the streets. And I think that is something that I understood while I was writing the book. But in Kabul, when I was walking, and when I'm walking in my hometown, it's a way of staking affinity to the place as well. It's saying that, you know, this is a place where I can put my body on the street. I can experience all the sights, the sounds, the feeling of the cold wind on my face, or the smell of soup in a roadside dhaba, you know, all of that stuff. I think a lot of people, because we've all done that, you know, we've all experienced places with our bodies, that was also a good way for me to invite readers into the city that felt very distant and alien. That was something I was very keen to argue with, that it's not an alien place. It's a place that you do know in some sense.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, I mean, that all opens up so many questions I want to ask you, and maybe we'll try and tackle all of them, but one at a time. I think listening to you speak about it, it seems quite obvious to me that, you know, you reference the reader so much when we're talking now. But also this journey is in a way deeply personal in terms of your origins and your access point to these stories and this place, but also your experiences of it, you know, these long stints of walking. And actually, author and journalist Sophie Roberts, who I know you know, and I think you've been on her podcast and maybe are friends, she said to me in her interview on this podcast, and I'll do a terrible job of remembering it verbatim, but her point was that some authors write to be read and some write for themselves. Which are you doing, or is it both?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a very Sophie question. That's a Sophie thing to say, I think, because she does such a good job of being both, you know, both the curious traveler and also the deeply introspective writer and thinker. I think definitely it was for me as a way of understanding the city. What was it that was so precious about it to me? It was really drilling down into what made it such a beautiful, life-changing experience to be in the city for me. But a lot of it also, I think this was the journalistic muscle kicking in, was to also just sort of argue with these ways of seeing of Kabul, and to, you know, argue not in a way of propaganda or polemic, but to, you know, offer this other version of the city, and, you know, to sort of through that, I think maybe to dismantle many of the lazy tropes and the stereotypes, which are, you know, besides everything else, they're just very boring. Because how long can you read about heroism, and how long can you read about one note sadness? I think it was so much more exciting to be in this place, which is full of complicated people with complicated stories and flawed characters, you know, instead of just being, you know, just speaking in this one voice. So it was that as well. But yeah, the idea of the reader didn't really come in while I was writing a lot. And I think that's why when the book came out, it was such a pleasant surprise for me to find that the book, and I'd heard this from other writers, but you don't really understand it, but that the book becomes completely different when you put it out in the world. Because every person I've spoken to has talked about how it connected with them in a different way. And there's no way I could have foreseen that. There's no way any writer can foresee any of that stuff happening. So it is true that it's something that's now a creation of every reader. I think the city of Kabul now, as I wrote it, is only true to me. For every reader, it's now a different city that they inhabit and they experience. But during the writing, the reader was not really present in my mind in the sense of it being of them being an interlocutor. It was more a conversation in my head with, here's how I've seen the city, and I'd love to share it with you because it's completely mind-blowingly beautiful, and it's so gentle. It exists at so many levels. It, you know, the past and the present are colliding in these very interesting ways, and I'd really like to share this vision.
It's so interesting because, you know, how wrong I was. I mean, I'd have guessed the complete opposite. And that's kind of, I guess, a testament to it in a way, is you feel like it's been written for you. I think that's one of the beauties of reading, isn't it? Is you just, you own these stories. They're for you. They're of you. And I guess that's good writing. You know, you feel like you've got ownership over it. But it, with all of that in mind, kind of, you know, you wrote it for you. It was of you. And the reader came later. Why were you writing it? What were you trying to achieve by writing it?
I think pretty much the same what I told you is that I'd had the good fortune to see the city. It was a time of great transformation. 2006 to 2013 was really the time when the war in Afghanistan went from being, you know, a positive story of, you know, at the time it was that the Taliban had been defeated, the narrative was that Al-Qaeda had been defeated. Afghans were ready for peace. The whole world came to rebuild the country. And then by 2013, the story had completely shifted. And 2014 was when ISAF had formally ended its combat operations. NATO had formally finished with Afghanistan. And it was a completely different mode. So I was able to see that entire shift at a very intimate level, being embedded in the everyday life of the city, not being embedded with the army or with consultants. And that was, you know, again, this was something that I realized when I was writing the book. But in the everydayness of it also, just the shifts felt important to record. It felt important to showcase how people were able to go on with their routine lives while dealing with these massive amounts of trauma, the everyday heroism of people that I saw. It felt like it would be a waste if I didn't write about it. And again, I think what I had done in my journalistic writing was to get sort of the truth or the facts of the city. Now, the facts were there in so many other stories. And this was something also which used to keep coming up, was, well, there's so many books on Afghanistan, why do you want to write one more? And also, by the time the book comes out, the city, you know, the place will be completely different. So is this a book about current affairs? I mean, what is it going to achieve at the end of it? And the only way to write was to ignore all of that and to write to what I had seen. I think something else that might be worth mentioning, although it is incredibly vulnerable to talk about these things, for that reason, I think it's important to talk about them, especially for women writers and for women writers of color who are not necessarily coming from places of power or locations of power, is that I found myself very often second-guessing the stuff that I found interesting and that really drew me in. For example, you know, wedding halls and beauty salons and, or, you know, even the Buddhist archaeological site. I found a lot of stories really interesting that didn't really connect with, let's say, traditional publishing or editors or news agendas. And I would always be second-guessing myself, think, okay, so is there something wrong with me? Is this even a thing? Am I just getting it completely wrong? Is this the wrong way to write a book about Kabul, basically, was a concern that I kept colliding against. And at some point, I had to really sit down and have this conversation with myself, was exactly this, like, why am I writing this book then? If I'm to be so hesitant in choosing what is interesting, what is important. And the answer I found, which I hope is helpful to other people struggling with similar questions, is that I felt that the stories I was listening to were worth recording, were worth sharing. And they said something much bigger than I could ever hope to do. You know, when I was with the women who were struggling with drug use and they were talking about how they dealt with their families and their young children who were also, you know, unfortunately had formed addiction to drug use because the family was using. How on earth could I not see that as something important and as an important voice? Because they were talking about something that was so much huger, that was opening up a completely different side to the city, and also something so personal and something so valuable, I felt, that it would be ridiculous for me to not share it simply because I didn't have confidence in myself. You know, so I had to sort of get over myself and write the book. I think that's really is, to put it in a very, very colloquial way, is a lot of the writing process, is you have to get over yourself and write the book simply because you feel that the people you're meeting or the things they're telling you are worth talking about.
Yeah, because what I'm about to say isn't necessarily true. It's incredibly complicated, but, you know, we've got different personalities. But I think you and I, being from the different backgrounds that we're from, you know, I've referenced my white British maleness a couple of times, but we've had very different lives and experiences. And, you know, for example, my framing of Kabul as this war-torn city full of soldiers in flak vests would have, like, profoundly influenced the way I would have told a story there. It couldn't not. I'd have struggled to step away from that. So how do you think, and you've kind of just spoken to this, but I'd really like to go into it, how do you think, if at all, your ethnicity, heritage, and gender allowed you access to the city in a way that I wouldn't have been able to have?
I don't, just to take issue with your statement a little bit, I want to push back against that. I don't think that's true. I think you would have found yourself really surprised. Have you been to Kabul? Okay, so then this is all hypothetical. But I think if you had been to Kabul, you would have found quite quickly that a lot of the stuff you'd seen about it was not really what you'd heard about. It was not really what you were seeing. And I agree that we are obviously shaped by the narratives that we receive, and so much of the mass, you know, the media narratives are really how we determine so many places. For instance, when I'm in London, and a lot of it is down to what I've read about it. And obviously that shapes the way I experience London, but also now the limitations of that one view are very evident to me. And I think that's the joy of travel, right? To find all our notions being challenged and to be bewildered and surprised at every turn. So I think it can be a part of your experience, but it won't be a part of it. It won't be the whole of it. But for me, I think it's similar. Like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I was very much shaped by mass media narratives of it. And I did have access to stories like the Kabuliwala and my own family's narratives, but they were marginal in the larger scheme of things. Being from India was definitely an advantage for me in Kabul. It was very different in different parts of the country. But in Kabul, I wouldn't say that being a woman was a huge advantage, but yes, it did let me sort of hang out in a way that I wouldn't have been able to as a man. But again, I feel that this is always a mix, bit of a mixed bag, you know, these kind of statements. And just in my experience, it was easy for me to connect with people in Kabul because they let me connect with them and because I was open to that connection. I had a lot of help in that. A lot of the cultural cues were similar to what I was accustomed to. And also, when I found something that I was accustomed to, it really gave me a thrill. You know, I was like so happy to find something that oh my God, like I know this. And so I really took it on, and I would just get into that situation with them. So, you know, at weddings, if there was music and dancing and, you know, people enjoying themselves, and I would know sort of how that went. But at the same time, like I was always like the plainest dressed person at a wedding. So sometimes they'd even have to explain that to me, like, oh, you know, she's not from here, to the other guests. So, but I think really the reason why there was a sense of ease in Kabul was, yes, definitely because I'm from India, and, you know, the language wasn't such a challenge to me because a lot of the people I was speaking to had either learned Urdu when they were refugees, or they had watched so many Bollywood films and TV shows that they had just learned it while watching them. Huge soft power of the mobile film industry was to my advantage. People really loved Indian films, Hindi films, and not just current, like not just the people who were young. It was an intergenerational love affair. So there were a lot of people who had grown up watching films when they were younger, and they had a lot to say about it. But that's a small part of it. And I have written about this previously, that this sort of tends to overshadow the sense of connection, but people, a lot of people I met felt a sense of connection to India, and they would tell it to me, and they would say it in a way that it felt like this was something that the Indians had forgotten, but they remembered. So they were sharing this with me as a gift. I thought that was really beautiful. And I think that was more important than the actual thing that we were talking about, the movie or the food. The sense of generosity in sharing their culture, I thought that was what really helped me connect with them.
Yeah, it makes total sense. And I think, you know, I'm glad you pushed back, and I suspect you might again with what I'm about to say, but I just, you know, I've traveled a lot and I've worked a lot in kind of the Middle East and North Africa and places like that. And I've found that, I mean, particularly with the gender stuff, but as well as being a Westerner, access can be quite difficult to secure. Or even when you do get access, there's this kind of semi-closed off otherness to my interactions with those people that sometimes have taken weeks to break down. I mean, I work a lot in Jordan through passion rather than for payment. And it's taken me years to build these relationships with certain people there, years to sort of almost like persuade them that I'm not, and big inverted commas here, because this is an audio podcast, like everybody else they encounter mm-hmm. who looks like me. And I think that would be my experience of Kabul, is they just, I look a lot like every British soldier who has ever stepped foot in that country. I'm a heavily tattooed, bald, bearded white man. You know, I do not look like a calming presence, right? Like that. So, yeah, I guess that's where I'm coming from, is I just wonder what it would be like for me, but maybe I should go and find out one day.
Someday, yeah.
So I think this, it does lead us on nicely in a way to another thing I want to talk about. And you know, I feel obliged to mention these days, I'm not just talking about gender with women on the podcast. I'm trying to introduce that conversation with men as well, because
I got
told off one day, and I was right to get told off for it. but I'm really interested in the specific kind of title of the book and the significance of the subtitle, you know, A Woman Walks Kabul. Was it important for you to make the kind of point in the title that you're a woman, as opposed to titling Walks in Kabul?
Yeah, but you know what listeners can't see is me nodding along vehemently during your question is, so the title that I was working with was very simply Walking in Kabul. That was my working title when I was writing the book. And I think in my head, that is still very much the title I think of. But the idea of Shadow City was a title that I grew to love. It didn't initially come from me, but it's a title that I think encompasses the many shades of the city that I was trying to achieve. It also captures the sense of the liminal space of the Kabul that I'm writing about, because it is a city that exists between, somewhere between fact and reality, somewhere between memory and dream, somewhere between, you know, a place that only one person can see and a place that can be actually, you know, shared with other people. So in that sense, the idea of a shadow is quite a useful one for me to have in the title. The idea of a woman walking Kabul, I think, was very much embedded in the book. And that was the structure of the book. I resisted having it in the title simply because I didn't want to center the woman in the way that the subtitle does at the moment. But again, at some point, I realized that that would be fundamentally dishonest, because that is the book. It is a woman taking you through the city, and the woman happens to be me, but that can also be any reader. That I think was what sold me on eventually the idea, was that it doesn't have to be a particular woman. That is a stand-in for all the readers who want to inhabit the city by walking, by having the freedom to wander through it. I think that in that sense the subtitle does the job, but it wasn't what I started out with.
Yeah, and I think, and this is probably just my news in my echo chamber, but I think what I found most interesting about it was that most of the things I've read or watched or listened to from Afghanistan are from the perspectives of men. You know, Western men or men mm-hmm. in Afghanistan, it tends to just be male voices. So I think it provides a completely different perspective in a way that, you know, I think it can be complicated to speak about this sort of thing in 2023, but it is a different perspective. I found it to be a very different perspective to the one I was used to. And that's why I think, going back to what you said earlier, you know, you didn't just write another book about Afghanistan. You wrote a fairly unique book about Afghanistan. I think that's what you achieved by approaching it in the way that you did. But something that really fascinated me was, in your book, you said you have a complicated relationship with walking.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to unpack that a little bit. What do you mean by that?
So I spoke about it a little bit, when I said that when I was growing up, we weren't supposed to be outside. And walking was one of the very, very, very difficult things to negotiate, because if you had to go somewhere, even if it's a short distance, you would either get a ride or take a cycle rickshaw because the streets were not really for women unless you had an agenda. The idea of loitering, which is, I think, a very interesting one. And there's this book that I always recommend about Mumbai, which is called Why Loiter, which is about how public spaces are not open to women in the same way they are to men, which is spaces of leisure, spaces of just wasted time. You know, the idea of loitering is not one that's really open to both genders. So that wasn't something that we were encouraged to do at all. I mean me and my cousins growing up in this house together. So, and I always had this sort of, a tendency to push back against this idea of not being of these proscribed spaces. And, let's see what happens if we do walk. And again, like I said, I'd learned how to negotiate by having this very urgent posture, by walking this very business-like way, so that nobody would have, the nerve to tell me, what are you doing here? So for that reason, I think the idea, I never took it for granted. I never took the fact that I could walk out into places for granted, but I was always very keen to know when I'm told that I can't do something and I find I can do it, but in a certain way, then that makes the place feel quite familiar. And that's what happened with Kabul, is that being told that you shouldn't walk anywhere. It's like, well, I've not that before. So then this sounds like a city that I may know already. And I think also when you're, doing things like walking around in places you're not supposed to be walking, I was using a lot of the tools or the intuition that I had as a woman, young woman, and then later as a college student in Delhi, where self-read the terrain for where are the places you can actually get into and where it might be dangerous or where the danger, what are the risks, how are they coming? And very often the risk is not where you expect it to be. It doesn't come in the shape you think it will. I found that with Kabul a lot. Like, there's this chapter which I've written about love, where a lot of it is about how love is very risky in Kabul, but the risk is not where you expect it to be. It comes in these like incredibly subtle surprises. It comes, in these, and how people bypass risk by all these different subversive tactics. And of course, it is always there. Which is something I kept being asked, like, are there really love affairs in Kabul? And it's just like, of course there are. I mean, where isn't there love in the world? But, so all of this stuff about walking was complicated in that I could do it and I knew that it was not easy and that it was something that had to be taken, not given. The more okay I was with not walking, the harder and harder it would be for me to not walk and also then to not do other things. So in that sense, it's a very, very rich metaphor. And again, like I mentioned, when you walk, you're at a pace which is actually natural to us. People talk about walking as slowing down. And I think this is an idea that is very resonant with the readers in the United Kingdom. Like, I found so much of writing around the UK is about walking, slowing down, nature. And I think it's not really slowing down. It's just a natural pace of us. Right? Like, everything else is fast. Walking is what we were designed to do. And it's a very political act also, like I said before, that when you're walking in a place of risk, and especially in Kabul, up to 2009, what had happened was that the international community and also the government had responded to increased suicide bombings in the city by building blast walls and by building there were sandbags, there were checkpoints. So the city was sort of retreating and the streets were being halved. So I would walk down the street and I'd find that half the city had vanished behind the security apparatus. So it was also in that sense, not just for the purpose of this book, but walking is a political act. You are putting your body out in the city or in the space in a way that embeds you in the environment, that you don't do if you're in a car or even in a bicycle, I think. I think for me, it's a gendered experience, like we discussed. And it's also the truest form of reportage, again, because then you can report with all your senses. You're not depending on any sort of filter between you and the world to talk about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the same is true of all of these forms, right? As a documentary filmmaker, I have exactly the same experience. Yeah. You know, going expedition, everything moves slowly, everything. And it completely alters the way that you view things rather than flying around from A to B. I mean, you speak to risk, and I think I've really deliberately tried to avoid the cliched questions in this conversation, but the one I do have to ask and try to frame it in a specific way is, you know, the inherent risks and dangers are obvious, I think, but did you ever experience any issues whilst you were walking, or was it plain sailing?
Let's see. It's hard to sort of answer this without, again, falling into cliche. So I always, you know, and a little bit before. But Kabul, when I was there, 2006 to 13, was a city which was going from relative security to increased danger. So, and a lot of the book is about that transformation. And walking, again, was helpful to me because it was a barometer for those transformations. So at the beginning, when I got there, it was relatively simple. Again, there's a lot of disclaimers to put in place with that, in that I was, you know, usually in the company of people. I didn't obviously look foreign. But even, you know, with all of that, it was relatively simple to be out without a need to be out, a sort of unagendaed, directionless, just a rambling walk around the city. Could see a lot of it on foot. By 2013, that had really changed. And again, the book is marking that it became a lot harder to just be out for no good reason. The walks I did take were very structured. They had to have reason. They had to have a time to them. And there was always a sort of, fixed trajectory to them. So that was a big change. I think the other big change was that it wasn't simply the idea of terrorist attacks or suicide bombings, but by, I want to say, 2011 to 13, a lot of the law and order had deteriorated so much that kidnappings were a big risk at that time as well, for Afghans as well as for foreign nationals. So that was always something that was present. And of course, there would be, the city of risk was always present in the city of leisure that we were trying to inhabit. And so often in the middle of a regular work day, there would be news of a suicide bombing or an explosion in a different part of the city or even nearby. And there would be a moment when everyone would take that time to make sure everyone was fine, that their families were safe. These are mechanisms that were embedded into the routine of every Kabuli. When you get to work, you let your family know. When you leave work, you let your family know. When you get home, you let your colleagues know. That was how they lived, I saw them living with risk. And then life would go on. So I think that's really the reality of how I experienced the risk, was that it was always there, never minimized. It was never not terrible, the things that happened. And it was also part of the larger rhythm of life that people were experiencing at that time. So I was also a small part of that. I had the luxury of being from elsewhere, had the luxury of a return ticket, which makes a big difference. But even within the limited time that I would be there, that was how it would play out in my routine.
Yeah, and it's been a decade since you were there now.
Yeah.
Is that a conscious choice because you've done what you needed to do, or is that because of the security situation?
I think after 2013, there was no compelling reason for me to really go back, also because a lot of my friends were leaving. And that's, again, something I've written about in the book, that it became harder for me to think of going back to Kabul if I had to live in a compound or if I had to sort of live in this circumscribed way. So even when those kind of opportunities did come up, I tended to say no because I couldn't bear to be in that kind of way in Kabul. And I think that was a large part of the reason why I didn't go back before 2021. Even earlier, from 13 onwards to 17, I think a lot of my good friends were leaving. So a lot of my reporting, they tended to shift with them. And I did a long series of essays from Hamburg about the Upland diaspora there, which followed a few people who I'd known in Kabul. But we were then in Hamburg, and we were talking about Kabul in Hamburg, and we were talking about their lives in Hamburg but I had seen them in Kabul, where they were filmmakers or they were musicians or they were creative people. And in Europe, they were now refugees. And that was the only voice they were supposed to speak. And that was the only story that they were, that was valuable to hear from them. And I think my lens also shifted with them to, from being Kabul within Kabul to Kabul outside of Kabul, which, you know, over 4 decades now of war displacement has created this incredibly strong sense of identity and culture outside of the physical country that I'm finding really interesting. After August 2021, I think it's incredibly challenging to go back, and also quite complicated in the sense that being back is really defined by the Taliban and your, you know, as a journalist there, how much of it are you serving their agendas by being there? It's really difficult. So both the reasons, I suppose, are the reason I haven't been back since 2013.
Is it even remotely tempting to go back now?
Oh, every day, of course. Because it's, you know, it's, I know that it's a completely different city from what I left behind. And I know that it'll be, and that's actually the interesting thing about having written a book about a city. And the city has completely changed. And I realized that that's exactly what cities do. And the book isn't about a defining moment in Kabul's life. It was about a time when it was putting on a new skin. And the book now is a document to that different city that I had the fortune to see. But also it's really important to recognize that it wasn't the only version or the only, different version of Kabul that you could see. It had changed before, it will change again. And of course, I'm very curious to see what's going on. I do have friends who are there who I would love to see. So if at any point it seems viable, then yeah, but yeah, every day it's tempting.
And when you reflect on it all, how do you think your experiences in Kabul have changed you and formed you as a person?
I think they really transformed me at a deeply personal way along with my professional practice. In that it helped me shed a lot of stuff, a lot of baggage that I thought is important for journalists to do, which is, you know, be objective or to stick to this, you know, weird idea of not putting your heart into your work. I think it really helped me throw that out pretty quick. It challenged so many things I thought I knew about so-called objective truths. It helped me see structures of power that exist behind seemingly neutral circumstances. I think just hanging out with Kabulese honed my already pretty dark sense of humor. The gallows humor that they practice is very, very dear to me now. The very ordinary and the very, like I said, the very incredible everyday heroism that I was able to witness, I think, is something that has been very transformative for me. And I really value now, I think, the idea of resistance, even when resistance seems futile. Again, this was something I had also, or it wasn't new to me. But if anything was needed to solidify this belief that even when everything seems lost, when it seems that there's nothing you can do, there is value in holding on to something you feel is just or something you feel is true.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I've been trying to over the course of this conversation, you know, committing to a project that essentially takes 15 years and dominates such a big part of your life. I mean, it's, I guess in a sense, it must have completely occupied who and what you were.
Yes, absolutely. It took over life and, you know, not just for me, but then by extension, my family as well. Because mentally, I would always be in Kabul. I think this was more, less when I was actually going to Kabul and more when I was trying to write Kabul off page, that it was incredibly hard for me because also I had to switch between my day job as a journalist and then also diving into these pages, which was still very nebulous. And it was just, I was desperate to finish it, but it was just something that took its own sweet time. I want to say, you know, when I started, I didn't realize it would be such a large chunk of my life and it would be such an intense process. But had I known, I think I would still go ahead with it because it was incredibly rewarding.
And so, to start to draw this to a close, because I'm very conscious of time, now that that's over and the book is out and in the world and doing incredibly well and winning awards, what's your focus now?
I think very much similar to what it's always been, which is to sort of find stories of so-called ordinary people and to get behind that surface and to be able to spend time. I think what I've really now I'm starting to fight for is the idea of time as a tool of journalism and nonfiction writing, because there's no good way to tell stories on the run. And of course, there's a place and a space for that. And I enjoy reading stories of movement, of quick impressions, which are delightful. And that is definitely something which has been a part of my diet, and I continue to read it. But it's not my tool of choice anymore. And I think, I'm now sort of based between London and India, and I'm enjoying exploring London. And I think I'm hopeful that there will be work coming out about that city or about that kind of setting. Let's see how that goes. But it's definitely interesting to be able to find a city that I'd only know first as a student and now, and then as a tourist, to have more time to spend there, to get into this incredibly diverse, crazy, dynamic place that, again, I've known mostly through reading.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more I would ask you, but I think, I'll start to call it there. I ask the same two questions at the end of every conversation. And the first is, what scares you?
I think ignorance scares me. Not having curiosity about a place, being absolutely dead to what's going on, what's going on.
And what brings you hope?
Always people give me hope somehow, despite the fact that people can be the opposite of hopeful. I think people always give me hope.
Amazing. Thank you so much. We'll leave it there. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. It was really great speaking to you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, then you can email me at matt@terraincognita.studio. And finally, as always, please do leave us an honest review on iTunes. They're a big help, and it really does help us bring the podcast to a wider audience.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.